content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. Continuing with our series on the 13 short stories written by J.D. Salinger for the New Yorker magazine, I'll read today part 4 of Zoe. If you miss parts 1 through 3, they are available at our website, ncreadingservice.org, under the podcast section, New Yorker Magazine, dates 11/11, 11/18, and 11/25, 2022. But first, I'll do a recap of parts 1 through 3. Franny comes home from college in a state of collapse. She is suffering spiritually, and it takes a great deal of talking on the part of her brother Zoe to straighten her out. She is 20, he is 25. There are several older brothers and another sister. The oldest child, Seymour, had committed suicide 7 years earlier. He had been a directive force in the family and was sorely missed. The next oldest boy, Buddy, who'd been very close to Seymour, now lived in a distant college town, teaching and writing. Mrs. Glass, their mother, simply wanted things to go smoothly. She wanted Franny to take some chicken broth and clear out of the living room so the painters could come in. We ended part 3 in the midst of a conversation between Franny and Zoe about religion and Franny's boyfriend Lane's reaction to her spirituality. And now, part 4 of Zoe by J.D. Salinger, published in the May 4, 1957 edition of the New Yorker magazine. "This is all so funny, you can't imagine," she said with the faintest tremor in her voice, and Zoe looked over at her. Her paleness was emphasized by the fact that she was wearing no lipstick at all. "Everything you're saying brings back everything I was trying to say to Lane on Saturday when he started digging at me. Right in the middle of martinis and snails and things. I mean, we're not bothered by exactly the same things, but by the same kind of things. I think, and for the same reasons. At least it sounds that way." Bloomberg just then stood up in her lap and, more like a dog than a cat, began to circle around to find a sleeping position he liked better. Franny, absently, yet like a guide, placed her hands gently on his back and went on speaking. "I actually reached a point where I said to myself, right out loud, like a lunatic, if I hear just one more picky, cavilling, unconstructive word out of you, Franny Glass, you and I are finished, but finished. And for a while, I wasn't too bad. For about a whole month, at least, whenever anybody said anything that sounded campusy and phony, or that smelled the high heaven of ego or something like that, I at least kept quiet about it. I went to the movies, or I stayed in the library all hours, or I started writing papers like mad on restoration comedy and stuff like that, but at least I had the pleasure of not hearing my own voice for a while." She shook her head. "Then one morning, bang, bang, I started up again. I didn't sleep all night for some reason, and I had an 8 o'clock in French Lit, so I finally just got up and got dressed and made some coffee and then walked around the campus. What I wanted to do was just go for a terribly long ride on my bike, but I was afraid everybody'd hear me taking my bike out of the stand. Something always falls. So I just went into the Lit building and sat. I sat and sat, and finally I got up and started writing things from Epictetus all over the blackboard. I filled the whole front blackboard. I didn't even know I remembered so much of him. I erased it, thank God, before people started coming in. But it was a childish thing to do anyway. Epictetus would have absolutely hated me for doing it, but," Franny hesitated, "I don't know. I think I just wanted to see the name of somebody nice up on the blackboard. Anyway, that started me up again. I picked all day. I picked on Professor Fallon. I picked on Lane when I talked to him on the phone. I picked on Professor Tupper. It got worse and worse, and I even started picking on my roommate. Oh, God, poor Bev. I started catching her looking at me as if she hoped I'd decide to move out of the room and let somebody halfway pleasant and normal move in and give her a little peace. It was just terrible. And the worst part was, I knew what a bore I was being. I knew how I was depressing people or even hurting their feelings, but I just couldn't stop. I just could not stop picking. Looking more than a little distraught, she paused just long enough to push downward on Bloomberg's roving hindquarters. It was the worst of all in class, though, she said with decision. That was the worst. What happened was I got the idea in my head, and I could not get it out, that college was just one more dopey, inane place in the world dedicated to piling up treasure on earth and everything. I mean, treasure is treasure, for heaven's sakes. What's the difference whether the treasure is money or property or even culture or even just plain knowledge? It all seemed like exactly the same thing to me if you take off the wrapping, and it still does. Sometimes I think that knowledge, when it's knowledge for knowledge's sake anyway, is the worst of all, the least excusable, certainly. Nervously, and without any real need whatever, Franny pushed back her hair with one hand. I don't think it would have all got me quite so down if just once in a while, there was at least some polite little perfunctory implication that knowledge should lead to wisdom, and that if it doesn't, it's just a disgusting waste of time. But there never is. You never even hear any hints dropped on campus that wisdom is supposed to be the goal of knowledge. You hardly ever even hear that the word wisdom being mentioned. Do you want to hear something funny? Do you want to hear something really funny? In almost 4 years of college, and this is the absolute truth, in almost 4 years of college, the only thing I can remember ever even hearing the expression wise man being used was in my freshman year in political science. And you know how it was used? It was used in reference to some nice old poopy elder statesman who'd made a fortune in the stock market and then gone to Washington to be an advisor to President Roosevelt. Honestly now, 4 years of college almost. Now, I'm not saying that happens to everybody, but I just got so upset when I think about it, I could die. She broke off and apparently became rededicated to serving Bloomberg's interests. Her lips now had very little more color in them than her face. They were also very faintly chapped. Zoe's eyes were on her and had been. I want to ask you something, Franny, he said abruptly. He turned back to the writing table surface again, frowned, and gave the snowman a shake. What do you think you're doing with the Jesus prayer? He asked. This is what I was trying to get at last night before you told me to go chase myself. You talk about piling up treasure, money, property, culture, knowledge, and so on and so on. In going ahead with the Jesus prayer, just let me finish now, please. In going ahead with the Jesus prayer, aren't you trying to lay up some kind of treasure? Something that's every goddamn bit as negotiable as all those others? More material things? Or does the fact that it's a prayer make all the difference? I mean by that, is there all the difference in the world for you in which side somebody lays up his treasure? This side or the other? The one where thieves can't break in, etc. Is that what makes a difference? Wait a second now. Just wait till I finish, please. He sat for a few seconds watching the little blizzard in the glass sphere then. There's something about the way you're going at this prayer that gives me the willies, if you want to know the truth. You think I'm out to stop you from saying it? I don't know whether I am or not. That's a goddamn debatable point. But I would like you to clear up for me just what the hell your motives are for saying it. He hesitated, but not long enough to give Franny a chance to cut in on him. As a matter of simple logic, there's no difference at all that I can see between the man who's greedy for material treasure or even intellectual treasure and the man who's greedy for spiritual treasure. As you say, treasure's treasure. God damn it, and it seems to me that 90% of all the world-hating saints in history were just as acquisitive and unattractive, basically, as the rest of us are. Franny said, as icily as she could, with a faint tremor in her voice, May I interrupt now, Zoe? Zoe let go of the snowman and picked up a pencil to play with. Yes, yes, interrupt.
I know all you're saying. You're not telling me one thing I haven't thought of by myself. You're saying I want something from the Jesus Prayer, which makes me just as acquisitive in your word, really as somebody who wants a sable coat, or to be famous, or to be dripping with some kind of crazy prestige. I know all that. My gosh, what kind of an imbecile do you think I am?
The tremor in her voice amounted now almost to an impediment.
All right, take it easy, take it easy. I can't take it easy. You make me so mad. What do you think I'm doing here in this crazy room? Losing weight like mad? Worrying Bessie and Les absolutely silly? Upsetting the house and everything? Don't you think I have sense enough to worry about my motives for saying the prayer? That's exactly what's bothering me so. Just because I'm choosy about what I want, in this case enlightenment or peace, instead of money or prestige or fame or any of those things, doesn't mean I'm not as egotistical and self-seeking as everybody else. If anything, I'm more so. I don't need the famous Zachary Glass to tell me that.
Here there was a marked break in her voice, and she began to be very attentive to Bloomberg again. Tears, presumably, were imminent, if not already on the way. Over at the writing table, Zoe, pressing down heavily with his pencil, was filling in the O's on the advertisement side of a small blotter. He kept this up for a little interval, and then flipped the pencil toward the inkwell. He picked up his cigar from the lip of the copper ashtray where he had placed it. It was now only about 2 inches in length, but was still burning. He took a deep drag on it, as if it were a kind of respirator in an otherwise oxygenless world. Then, almost forcibly, he looked over at Franny again. "Do you want me to try to get Buddy on the phone for you tonight?" he asked. "I think you should talk to somebody. I'm no damn good for this." He waited, looking at her steadily. "Franny, what about it?" Franny's head was bowed. She appeared to be searching for fleas in Bloomberg's coat, her fingers very busy indeed turning back tufts of fur. She was, in fact, crying now, but in a very local sort of way, as it were. There were tears, but no sounds. Zoe watched her for a full minute or so and then said, not precisely kindly, but without importuning, "Franny, what about it? Shall I try to get Buddy on the phone?" She shook her head without raising it. She went on searching for fleas, and then, after an interval, she did reply to Zoe's question, but not very audibly. "What?" Zoe asked. Franny repeated her statement.
"I want to talk to Seymour," she said.
Zoe went on looking at her for a moment, his face essentially expressionless, discounting a line of perspiration on his rather long and singularly Irish upper lip. Then, with characteristic abruptness, he turned back and resumed filling in O's. But he put down the pencil almost immediately. He got up from the writing table, rather slowly for him, and taking his cigar stub with him, reassumed his one-foot-up stance at the window seat. A taller, longer-legged man, any one of his brothers, for example, might have put his foot up, might have made the stretch with greater ease. But once Zoe's foot was up, he gave the impression of sustaining a dancer's position. At first piecemeal, and then point blank, he let his attention be drawn to a little scene that was being acted out sublimely, unhampered by writers and directors and producers, 5 stories below the window and across the street. A fair-sized maple tree stood in front of the girls' private school, one of 4 or 5 trees on that fortunate side of the street. And at the moment, a child of 7 or 8, female, was hiding behind it. She was wearing a navy blue reefer and a tam that was very nearly the same shade of red as the blanket on the bed in Van Gogh's room at Arles. Her tam did, in fact, from Zoe's vantage point, appear not unlike a dab of paint. Some 15 feet away from the child, her dog, a young dachshund wearing a green leather collar and leash, was sniffing to find her, scurrying in frantic circles, his leash dragging behind him. The anguish of separation was scarcely bearable for him, and when at last he picked up his mistress's scent, it wasn't a second too soon. The joy of reunion for both was immense. The dachshund gave a little yelp, then cringed forward, shimmying with ecstasy, till his mistress, shouting something at him, stepped hurriedly over the wire guard surrounding the tree and picked him up. She said a number of words of praise to him in the private argot of the game, and then put him down and picked up his leash, and the two walked gaily west toward Fifth Avenue and the park and out of Zoe's sight. Zoe reflexively put his hand on a crosspiece between panes of glass, as if he had a mind to raise the window and lean out of it to watch the two disappear. It was his cigar hand, however, and he hesitated a second or two long. He dragged on his cigar. "God damn it," he said. "There are nice things in the world, and I mean nice things. We're all such morons to get so sidetracked. Always, always, always referring every goddamn thing that happens right back to our lousy little egos." Behind him, just then, Franny blew her nose with guileless abandon. The report was considerably louder than might have been expected from so fine and delicate appearing an organ. Zoe turned around to look at her, somewhat censoriously. Franny, busy with several folds of Kleenex, looked at him. "Well, I'm sorry," she said. "Can't I blow my nose?" "You finished?" "Yes, I'm finished. My gosh, what a family. You take your life in your hands if you just blow your nose." Zoe turned back to the window. He smoked briefly, his eyes following a pattern of concrete blocks in the school building. "Buddy once said something reasonably sensible to me a couple of years ago," he said. "If I can remember what it was." He hesitated, and Franny, though still busy with her Kleenex, looked over at him. When Zoe appeared to have difficulty in remembering something, his hesitation invariably interested all his brothers and sisters, and even held some entertainment value for them. His hesitations were almost always specious. Most of the time they were direct carryovers from the five undoubtedly formative years he had spent as a regular panelist on It's a Wise Child, when, rather than seem to flaunt his somewhat preposterous ability to quote instantaneously and usually verbatim almost anything he had ever read or even listened to with genuine interest, he cultivated a habit of furrowing his brow and appearing to stall for time, the way the other children on the program did. His brow was furrowed now, but he spoke up rather more quickly than was customary under the circumstances, as though he sensed that Franny, his old co-panelist, had caught him at it. He said that a man should be able to lie at the bottom of a hill with his throat cut, slowly bleeding to death, and if a pretty girl or an old woman should pass by with a beautiful jug balanced perfectly on the top of her head, he should be able to raise himself up on one arm and see the jug safely over the top of the hill. He thought this over and then gave a mild snort. "I'd like to see him do it, the bastard." He took a drag in his cigar. "Everybody in this family gets his goddamn religion in a different package," he commented, with a notable absence of awe in his tone. "Walt was a hot one. Walt and Boo Boo had the hottest religious philosophies in the family." He dragged on his cigar, as if to offset being amused when he didn't care to be. "Walt once told Waker that everybody in the family must have piled up one hell of a lot of bad karma in his past incarnations. He had a theory, Walt, that the religious life and all the agony that goes with it is just something God sicks on people who have the gall to accuse him of having created an ugly world." A titter of audience appreciation came from the couch. "I never heard that," Franny said. "What's Boo Boo's religious philosophy? I didn't think she had any." Zoe said nothing for a moment and then said, "Boo Boo's? Boo Boo's convinced Mr. Ash made the world. She got it from Kilvert's diary. The school children in Kilvert's parish were asked who made the world, and one of the kids answered, Mr. Ash." Franny was delighted, and audibly so. Zoe turned and looked at her, and, unpredictable young man, made a very dour face, as though he had suddenly eschewed any and all forms of levity. He took down his foot from the window seat, parked his cigar end in the copper ashtray on the writing table, and came away from the window. He moved across the room slowly, hands in his hip pockets, but not without some direction in his mind. "I should get the hell out of here. I've got a lunch date," he said, and immediately stooped to make a leisurely and proprietary examination of the interior of the fish tank. He tapped on the glass with his fingernail, importunately. "I turn my back for 5 minutes and everybody lets my black mollies die off. I should have taken them to college with me. I knew that."
"Oh, Zoe, you've been saying that for 5 years. Why don't you go buy some new ones?"
He went on tapping on the glass. "All you college snips are the same, hard as nails. These weren't just any black mollies, buddy. We were very close." So saying, he stretched out on his back on the carpet again, his slight torso fitting in rather tightly between the 1932 Stromberg Carlson table radio and an overfilled maple magazine stand. Again, only the soles and heels of his brogues were visible to Franny. However, no sooner was he stretched out than he sat bolt upright, his head and shoulders suddenly propelled into view, with somewhat the macabre comic effect of a corpse falling out of a closet. "Prayer's still going, eh?" he said. Then he dropped back out of sight again. He was still for a moment. Then, in an almost unintelligibly thick Mayfair accent, "I'd rather like a word with you, Miss Glass, if you've a moment." The response to this over at the couch was a distinctly ominous silence. "Say your prayer if you want to, or play with Bloomberg, or feel free to smoke. But give me 5 minutes of uninterrupted silence, buddy. And if possible, no tears at all, okay? You hear me?" Franny didn't answer straight away. She brought her legs in closer to her under the afghan, and gathered in the sleeping Bloomberg somewhat closer to her, too. "I hear you," she said, and drew her legs in still closer to her, as a fortress draws up its bridge before the siege. She hesitated, and then spoke up again. "You can say anything you want if you don't get abusive about it. I just don't feel like a workout this morning, I mean."
"No workouts, no workouts, buddy. And if there's one thing I never am, it's abusive."
The speaker's hands were folded benignly on his chest. "Oh, a little brisk? Sometimes, yes, when the situation warrants. Abusive? Never. Personally, I've always found that you can catch more flies with..."
"I mean it now, Zoe," Franny said, more or less addressing his brogues. "And I wish you'd sit up, incidentally. Every time all hell breaks loose around here, it seems very funny to me that it always comes from that spot right where you're lying, and you're always the one that's there. Come on now, just please sit up."
So he closed his eyes. "Fortunately, I know you don't mean that. Not deep down. We both know, deep in our hearts, that this is the only piece of hallowed ground in this whole goddamn haunted house. This happens to be where I used to keep my rabbits, and they were saints, both of them. As a matter of fact, they were the only celibate rabbits in the..."
"Oh, shut up," Franny said nervously.
"Just start, if you're going to. All I ask is that you at least try to be a little bit tactful the way I'm feeling right now. That's all. You are without a doubt the most tactless person I've ever known in my life."
"Tactless? Never. Outspoken, yes. High-spirited, yes. Meddlesome. Sanguine, perhaps, to a fault, but no one has ever..."
"I said tactless," Franny overrode him, with considerable heat, yet trying not to be amused.
"Just get sick sometime and go visit yourself, and you'll find out how tactless you are. You're the most impossible person to have around when somebody's not feeling up to par that I've ever known in my life. If somebody just has a cold, even, you know what you do? You give them a dirty look every time you see them. You're absolutely the most unsympathetic person I've ever known. You are."
All right, Zoe said with his eyes still closed. "Nobody's perfect, buddy."
Effortlessly, by softening and thinning his voice, rather than by raising it to a falsetto, he gave what was to Franny a familiar and always realistic imitation of their mother passing along a few cautionary words.
"We say many things in heat, young lady, that we don't really mean and are very sorry for the next day."
Then instantly he frowned, opened his eyes, and stared for several seconds at the ceiling. "Firstly," he said, "I think you think I have intentions of trying to take your prayer away from you or something."
"I don't. I do not."
"You can lie on that couch reciting the preamble to the Constitution for the rest of your life, as far as I'm concerned. But what I am trying..."
"Well, that's a beautiful start. Just beautiful.
Beg pardon."
"Oh, shut up. Just go on. Go on."
"What I started to say, I have nothing against the prayer at all. No matter what you think. You're not the first one who ever thought of saying it, you know. I once went to every Army and Navy store in New York looking for a nice pilgrim-type rucksack. I was going to fill it with breadcrumbs and start walking all over the goddamn country, saying the prayer. Spreading the word. The whole business." And Zoe hesitated. "And I don't just mention it, for God's sake, to show you I was once an emotional young person just like yourself."
"Well, why do you mention it then?"
"Why do I mention it? I mention it because I have a couple of things I want to say to you, and it's just possible I'm not qualified to say them. On the ground that I once had a strong desire to say the prayer myself, but didn't. For all I know, I may be a little jealous of your having a go at it. It's very possible, in fact. In the first place, I'm a ham. It may very well be that I hate like hell to play Martha to somebody else's Mary. Who the hell knows?" Franny didn't choose to reply, but she drew Bloomberg slightly closer to her and gave him an odd, ambiguous little hug. Then she looked over in her brother's direction and said, "You're a brownie. Did you know that?" "Just hold the compliments, buddy. You may live to retract them. I'm still going to tell you what I don't like about the way you're going at this business, qualified or not." Here Zoe stared blankly at the plaster ceiling for a matter of 10 seconds or so, and then closed his eyes again. "Firstly," he said, "I don't like this Camille routine. And don't interrupt me now. I know you're legitimately falling apart and all that. And I don't think it's an act. I don't mean that. I don't think it's a subconscious plea for sympathy or any of that business, but I still say I don't like it. It's rough on Bessie, it's rough on Les, and if you don't know it yet, you're beginning to give off a little stink of piousness. God damn it, there isn't any prayer in any religion in the world that justifies piousness. I'm not saying you are pious, so just sit still, but I am saying all this hysteria business is unattractive as hell."
"Are you finished?" Franny said, sitting very notably forward. The tremor had returned to her voice.
"All right, Franny. Come on now. You said you'd hear me out. I've said the worst, I think. I'm just trying to tell you. I'm not trying, I'm telling you. That this is just not fair to Bessie and Les. It's terrible for them, and you know it. Did you know, God damn it, that Les was all for bringing a tangerine to you last night before you went to bed? My God. Even Bessie can't stand stories with tangerines in them. And God knows I can't. If you're going to go with this breakdown business, I wish to hell you'd go back to college to have it, where you're not the baby of the family, and where, God knows, nobody will have any urges to bring you any tangerines, and where you don't keep your goddamn tap shoes in the closet." Franny, at this point, reached rather blindly but soundlessly for the box of Kleenex on the marble coffee table. Zoe was now gazing abstractly at an old root beer stain on the ceiling plaster, which he himself had made 19 or 20 years earlier with a water pistol. "The next thing that bothers me," he said, "isn't pretty either. But I'm almost finished, so hang on a second if you can. What I don't like at all is this little hair-shirty private life of a martyr you're living back at college, this little snotty crusade you think you're leading against everybody. And I don't mean what you may think I mean, so try not to interrupt for a second. I take it that mostly you're gunning against the system of higher education. Don't spring at me now. For the most part, I agree with you. But I hate the kind of blanket attack you're making on it. I agree with you about 98% on the issue, but the other 2% scares me half to death. I had one professor when I was in college, just one, I'll grant you, but he was a big, big one, who just doesn't fit in with anything you've been talking about. He wasn't Epictetus, but he was no egomaniac. He was no faculty charm boy. He was a great and modest scholar. And what's more, I don't think I ever heard him say anything, either in or out of a classroom, that didn't seem to me to have a little bit of real wisdom in it, and sometimes a lot of it. What'll happen to him when you start your revolution? I can't bear to think about it. Let's change the goddamn subject. These other people you've been ranting about are something else again. This Professor Tupper and these other two goons you were telling me about last night, Manlius and the other one, I've had them by the dozens, and so has everybody else, and I agree, they're not harmless. They're lethal as hell, as a matter of fact. God Almighty, they make everything they touch turn absolutely academic and useless, or worse, cultish. To my mind, they're mostly to blame for the mob of ignorant oafs with diplomas that are turned loose on the country every June. Here's Zoe, still looking at the ceiling, simultaneously grimaced and shook his head. But what I don't like, and what I don't think either Seymour or Buddy would like either, as a matter of fact, is the way you talk about all these people. I mean, you don't just despise what they represent. You despise them. It's too damn personal, Franny. I mean it. You get a real little homicidal glint in your eye when you talk about this Tupper, for instance. All this business about his going into the men's room to muss his hair before he comes into class. All that. He probably does. It goes with everything else you've told me about him. I'm not saying it doesn't, but it's none of your business, buddy, what he does with his hair. It would be all right, in a way, if you thought his personal affectations were sort of funny, or if you felt a little tiny bit of sorry for him for being insecure enough to give himself a little pathetic goddamn glamour. But when you tell me about it, and I'm not fooling now, you tell me about it as though his hair was a goddamn personal enemy of yours. That is not right, and you know it. If you're going to go to war against the system, just do your shooting like a nice, intelligent girl, because the enemy's there, and not because you don't like his hairdo or his goddamn necktie. A silence followed for a minute or so. It was broken only by the sound of Franny blowing her nose, an abandoned, protracted, congested blow, suggestive of a patient with a four-day-old head cold. It's exactly like this damned ulcer I picked up. Do you know why I have it? Or at least 9/10 of the reason I have it? Because when I'm not thinking properly, I let my feelings about television and everything else get personal. I do exactly the same thing you do. And I'm old enough to know better. Zoe paused, his gaze fixed on the root beer spot. He took a deep breath through his nose. His fingers were still laced across his chest. This last thing, he said abruptly, will probably cause an explosion. But I can't help it. It's the most important thing of all. He appeared to consult the ceiling plaster briefly and then closed his eyes. I don't know if you remember, but I remember a time around here, buddy, when you were going through a little apostasy from the New Testament that could be heard for miles around. Everybody was in the goddamn army at the time, and I was the one that got his ear bent. But do you remember? Do you remember it at all? Well, I was all of 10 years old, Franny said nasally, rather dangerously. I know how old you were. I know very well how old you were. Come on now. I'm not bringing this up with the idea of throwing anything back in your teeth. My God. I'm bringing this up for a good reason. I'm bringing it up because I don't think you understood Jesus when you were a child, and I don't think you understand him now. I think you've got him confused in your mind with about 5 or 10 other religious personages, and I don't see how you can go ahead with the Jesus prayer till you know who's who and what's what. Do you remember at all what started off that little apostasy, Franny? Do you remember or don't you? He didn't get an answer. only the sound of a nose being rather violently blown. Well, I do, it happens. Matthew, chapter 6. I remember it very clearly, buddy. I even remember where I was. I was back in my room putting some friction tape on my goddamn hockey stick, and you banged in, all in an uproar with the Bible wide open. You didn't like Jesus anymore, and you wanted to know if you could call Seymour at his army camp and tell him all about it. And you know why you didn't like Jesus anymore? I'll tell you. Because, one, you didn't approve of his going into the synagogue and throwing all the tables and idols all over the place. That was very rude, very unnecessary. You were sure that Solomon or somebody wouldn't have done anything like that. And the other thing you disapproved of, the thing you had the Bible open to, was the lines, "Behold the fowls of the air, for they sow not, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns, yet your heavenly Father feedeth them." That was all right. That was lovely. That you approved of. But when Jesus says in the same breath, "Are ye not much better than they?" Ah, that's where little Franny gets off. That's where little Franny quits the Bible cold and goes straight to Buddha, who doesn't discriminate against all those nice fowls of the air, all those sweet, lovely chickens and geese that we used to keep up at the lake. And don't tell me again that you were 10 years old. Your age has nothing to do with what I'm talking about. There are no big changes between 10 and 20, or 10 and 80 for that matter. You still can't love a Jesus as much as you'd like to, who did and said a couple of things he was at least reported to have said or done, and you know it. You're constitutionally unable to love or understand any son of God who throws tables around. You're constitutionally unable to love or understand any son of God who says a human being, any human being, even a Professor Tupper, is more valuable to God than any soft, helpless Easter chick. Franny was now facing directly into the sound of Zoe's voice, sitting bolt upright, a wad of Kleenex clenched in one hand. Bloomberg was no longer in her lap. "I suppose you can," she said shrilly. "It's beside the point whether I can or not, but yes, as a matter of fact, I can. I don't feel like going into it, but at least I've never tried, consciously or otherwise, to turn Jesus into St. Francis of Assisi, to make him more lovable, which is exactly what 98% of the Christian world has always insisted on doing. Not that it's to my credit. I don't happen to be attracted to the St. Francis of Assisi type. But you are. And in my opinion, that's one of the reasons why you're having this little nervous breakdown. And especially the reason why you're having it at home. This place is made to order for you. The service is good and there's plenty of hot and cold running ghosts. What could be more convenient? You can say your prayer here and roll Jesus and St. Francis and Seymour and Heidi's grandfather all in one." Zoe's voice stopped very briefly. "Can't you see that? Can't you see how unclearly, how sloppily you're looking at things? My God, there's absolutely nothing tenth rate about you, and yet you're up to your neck at this minute in tenth rate thinking. Not only is the way you're going at your prayer tenth rate religion, but whether you know it or not, you're having a tenth rate nervous breakdown. I've seen a couple of real breakdowns, and the people who had them didn't bother to pick and choose the place they..." "Just stop it, Zoe, just stop it," Franny said, sobbing. "I will, in a minute, just a minute. Why are you breaking down, incidentally? I mean, if you're able to go into a collapse with all your might, why can't you use the same energy to stay well and busy? All right, so I'm being unreasonable. I'm being very unreasonable now, but my God, how you try what little patience I was born with. You take a look around your college campus and the world and politics and one season of summer stock, and you listen to the conversation of a bunch of nitwit college students, and you decide that everything's ego, 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 and the only intelligent thing for a girl to do is to lie around and shave her head and say the Jesus prayer and beg God for a little mystical experience that'll make her nice and happy." Franny shrieked, "Will you shut up, please?" In just a second. You keep talking about ego. My God, it would take Christ himself to decide what's ego and what isn't. This is God's universe, buddy, not yours, and he has the final say about what's ego and what isn't. What about your beloved Epictetus or your beloved Emily Dickinson? You want your Emily, every time she has an urge to write a poem, to just sit down and say a prayer till her nasty, egotistical urge goes away? No, of course you don't. But you'd like your friend Professor Tupper's ego taken away from him. That's different, and maybe it is. But don't go screaming about egos in general. In my opinion, if you really want to know, half the nastiness in the world is stirred up by people who aren't using their true egos. Take your Professor Tupper. From what you say about him, anyway, I'd lay almost any odds that this thing he's using, the thing you think is his ego, isn't his ego at all, but some other much dirtier, much less basic faculty. My God, you've been around schools long enough to know the score. Scratch an incompetent school teacher, or, for that matter, college professor, and half the time you find a displaced first-class automobile mechanic or a goddamn stonemason. Take Lesage, for instance. My friend, my employer, my Rose of Madison Avenue. You think it was his ego that got him into television? Like hell it was. He has no ego anymore, if ever he had one. He's split it up into hobbies. He has at least three hobbies that I know of, and they all have to do with a big $10,000 workroom in his basement, full of power tools and vices and God knows what else. Nobody who's really using his real ego, has any time for any goddamn hobbies. Zoe suddenly broke off. He was still lying with his eyes closed and his fingers laced quite tightly across his chest, his shirt front. But he now ground his face into a deliberately pained expression, a form apparently of self-criticism. Hobbies, he said. How did I get off into hobbies? He lay still for a moment. Franny's sobs, no more than partly muffled by a satin pillow, made the only sound in the room. Bloomberg was now sitting under the piano, on an island of sunshine, rather picturesquely washing his face. Always the heavy, Zoe said, a trifle too matter-of-factly. No matter what I say, I sound as though I'm undermining your Jesus prayer. And I'm not, goddammit. All I am is against why and how and where you're using it. I'd like to be convinced. I'd love to be convinced that you're not using it as a substitute for doing whatever the hell your duty is in life or just your daily duty. Worse than that, though, I can't see, I swear to God I can't, how you can pray to a Jesus you don't even understand. And what's really inexcusable, considering that you've been funnel-fed on just about the same amount of religious philosophy that I have, what's really inexcusable is that you don't try to understand him. There'd be some excuse for it if you were either a very simple person, like the pilgrim, or a very goddamn desperate person. But you're not simple, buddy, and you're not that damn desperate. Just then, for the first time since he had lain down, Zoe, with his eyes still shut, compressed his lips, very much as a matter of parenthetical fact, in the habitual style of his mother. God Almighty, Franny, he said, if you're going to say the Jesus prayer, at least say it to Jesus and not to St. Francis and Seymour and Heidi's grandfather all wrapped up in one. Keep him in mind if you say it, and him only, and him as he was, and not as you'd like him to have been. You don't face any facts. This same damned attitude of not facing facts is what got you into this messy state of mind in the first place, and it can't possibly get you out of it. Zoe abruptly placed his hands over his now quite damp face, left them there for an instant, and then removed them. He refolded them. His voice picked up again, almost perfectly conversational in tone. The part that stumps me, really stumps me, is that I can't see why anybody, unless he was a child or an angel or a lucky simpleton like the pilgrim, would even want to say the prayer to a Jesus who was the least bit different from the way he looks and sounds in the New Testament. My God, He's only the most intelligent man in the Bible, that's all. Who isn't he head and shoulders over? Who? Both Testaments are full of pundits, prophets, disciples, favorite sons, Solomon's, Isaiah's, David's, Paul's, but my God, who besides Jesus really knew which end was up? Nobody. Not Moses. Don't tell me about Moses. He was a nice man, and he kept in beautiful touch with his God and all that. But that's exactly the point. He had to keep in touch. Jesus realized there is no separation from God. Zoe here clapped his hands together, and only once, and not loud, and very probably in spite of himself. His hands were refolded across his chest, almost as it were before the clap was out. "Oh, my God, what a mind," he said. "Who else, for example, would have kept his mouth shut when Pilate asked for an explanation? Not Solomon. Don't say Solomon. Solomon would have had a few pithy words for the occasion. I'm not sure Socrates wouldn't have, for that matter. Crito or somebody would have managed to pull him aside just long enough to get a couple of well-chosen words for the record. But most of all, about everything else, who in the Bible besides Jesus knew that we're carrying the kingdom of heaven around with us, inside, where we're all too goddamn stupid and sentimental and unimaginative to look? You have to be a son of God to know that kind of stuff. Why don't you think of these things? I mean it, Franny. I'm being serious. When you don't see Jesus for exactly what he was, you miss the whole point of the Jesus prayer. If you don't understand Jesus, you can't understand his prayer. You don't get the prayer at all. You just get some kind of organized can't. Jesus was a supreme adept by God on a terribly important mission. There was no St. Francis with enough time to knock out a few canticles or to preach to the birds or to do any of the other endearing things so close to Franny Glass's heart. I'm being serious now. God damn it. How can you miss seeing that? If God had wanted somebody with St. Francis's consistently winning personality for the job in the New Testament, he'd have picked him. You can be sure. And it was. He picked the best, the smartest, the most loving, the least sentimental, the most unimitative master he could have possibly picked. And when you miss seeing that, I swear to you, you're missing the whole point of the Jesus Prayer. The Jesus Prayer has one aim and one aim only, to endow the person who says it with Christ consciousness. Not to set up some little cozy, holier-than-thou trysting place with some sticky, adorable, divine personage who'd take you in his arms and relieve you of all your duties and make all your nasty Weltschmerzen and Professor Tuppers go away and never come back. And by God, if you have enough intelligence to see that, and you do, and yet you refuse to see it, then you're misusing the prayer. And you're using it to ask for a world full of dolls and saints and no Professor Tuppers. He suddenly sat up, shot forward with an almost calisthenic-like swiftness to look at Franny. His shirt was, in the familiar phrase, wringing wet. If Jesus had intended the prayer to be used for... Zoe broke off. He stared over at Franny's prostrate, face-down position on the couch and heard probably... for the first time, the only partly stifled sounds of anguish coming from her. In an instant, he turned pale. Pale with anxiety for Franny's condition, and pale, presumably, because failure had suddenly filled the room with its invariably sickening smell. The color of his pallor, however, was a curiously basic white, unmixed, that is, with the greens and yellows of guilt or abject contrition. It was like the standard bloodlessness in the face of a small boy who loves animals to distraction, all animals, and who has just seen his favorite bunny-loving sister's expression as she opened the box containing his birthday present to her, a freshly caught young cobra with a red ribbon tied in an awkward bow around its neck. He stared at Franny for a full minute, then got to his feet, with a little uncharacteristically awkward movement of imbalance. He went, very slowly, over to his mother's writing table on the other side of the room. And it was clear, on arrival, that he had no idea why he'd gone over to it. He seemed unfamiliar with the things on the table surface. The blotter with his filled-in O's, the ashtray with his cigar in it, and he turned around and looked at Franny again. Her sobbing had let up a bit, or seemed to have, but her body was in the same wretched, prostrate, face-down position. One arm was bent under her, caught under her, in a way that must have been acutely uncomfortable, if not rather painful. Zoe looked away from her and then, not unbravely, back at her. He wiped his brow briefly with the palm of his hand, put the hand into his hip pocket to dry it, and said, "I'm sorry, Franny. I'm very sorry." But this formal apology only reactivated, reamplified Franny's sobbing. He looked at her fixedly for another 15 or 20 seconds. Then he left the room via the hall, closing the door behind him. The fresh paint smell was now quite strong just outside the living room. The hall itself had not yet been painted, but newspapers had been strewn the entire length of the hardwood floor, and Zoe's first step, an indecisive, almost dazed one, left the imprint of his rubber heel on a sports section photograph of Stan Musial holding up a 14-inch brook trout. On his fifth or sixth step, he barely missed colliding with his mother, who had just come out of her bedroom. "I thought you'd gone," she said. She was carrying two laundered and folded cotton bedspreads. "I thought I heard the front." She broke off to take in Zoe's general appearance. "What is that, perspiration?" she asked. Without waiting for a reply, she took Zoe by the arm and led him, almost swept him, as if he were as light as a broom, into the daylight coming out of her freshly painted bedroom. "It is perspiration." Her tone couldn't have held more wonder and censure if Zoe's pores had been exuding crude oil. "What in the world have you been doing? You just had a bath. What have you been doing?" "I'm late now, Fatty. Come on, one side," Zoe said. A Philadelphia highboy had been moved out into the hall, and, together with Mrs. Glass's person, it blocked Zoe's passage. "Who put this monstrosity out here?" he said, glancing at it. "Why are you perspiring like that?" Mrs. Glass demanded, staring first at the shirt and then at him. "Did you talk to Franny? Where have you just been? The living room?" "Yes, yes, the living room. And if I were you, incidentally, I'd go look in there for a second. She's crying, or was when I left." He tapped his mother on the shoulder. "Come on now, I mean it. Get out of the..." "She's crying again? Why? What happened?" "I don't know, for Christ's sake. I hit her poo books. Come on now, Bessie, step aside, please. I'm in a hurry." Mrs. Glass, still staring at him, let him pass. Then, almost at once, she made for the living room, at a clip that scarcely gave her leave to call back over her shoulder. "Change that shirt, young man!" If Zoe heard this, he gave no sign. At the far end of the hall, he went into the bedroom he had once shared with his twin brothers, which now, in 1955, was his alone. But he stayed in his room for not more than 2 minutes. When he came out, he had on the same sweaty shirt. There was, however, a slight but fairly distinct change in his appearance. He had acquired a cigar and lighted it. And, for some reason, he had an unfolded white handkerchief draped over his head, possibly to ward off rain or hail or brimstone. He went directly across the hall and into the room his two eldest brothers had shared. This was the first time in almost 7 years that Zoe had, in the ready-made dramatic idiom, set foot in Seymour's and Buddy's old room. Discounting a totally negligible incident a couple of years earlier when he had methodically dragged the entire apartment for a mislaid or stolen tennis racket press. He closed the door behind him as tightly as possible, and with an expression implying that the absence of a key in the lock met his disapproval. He gave the room itself scarcely a glance once he was inside it. Instead, he turned around and deliberately faced a sheet of what had once been snow-white beaver board that was nailed uncompromisingly to the back of the door. It was a mammoth specimen, very nearly as long and as wide as the door itself. One could have believed that its whiteness, smoothness, and expanse had at one time cried out rather plaintively for India ink and block lettering. Certainly not in vain, if so. Every inch of visible surface of the board had been decorated with four somewhat gorgeous-looking columns of quotations from a variety of the world's literatures. The lettering was minute, but jet black and passionately legible, if just a trifle fancy in spots and without blots or erasures. The workmanship was no less fastidious, even at the bottom of the board, near the door sill, where the two penmen, each in his turn, had obviously lain on their stomachs. No attempt whatever had been made to assign quotations or authors to categories or groups of any kind, so that to read the quotations from top to bottom, column by column, was rather like walking through an emergency station set up in a flood area, where, for example, Pascal had been unribaldly bedded down with Emily Dickinson, and where, so to speak, Baudelaire's and Thomas A. Kempis's toothbrushes were hanging side by side. Zoe, standing in just close enough, read the top entry in the left-hand column, and then went on reading downward. From his expression, or lack of it, he might have been killing time on a railway platform reading a billboard advertisement for Dr. Scholl's foot pads. You have the right to work, but for the work's sake only. You have no right to the fruits of work. Desire for the fruits of work must never be your motive in working. Never give way to laziness either. Perform every action with your heart fixed on the Supreme Lord. Renounce attachment to the fruits. Be even-tempered, underlined by one of the calligraphers, in success and failure, for it is this evenness of temper which is meant by yoga. Work done with anxiety about results is far inferior to work done without such anxiety in the calm of self-surrender. Seek refuge in the knowledge of Brahman. They who work selfishly for results are miserable. The Bhagavad Gita. Well, we're out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it, and you'll be sure and listen next week for the fifth and final part of Zoe by J.D. Salinger. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thanks for listening.